The following is a presentation of the Matt Talk Podcast Network.
Welcome to On the Mat. I am Kyle Klingman of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame Dan Gable Museum, joined by a man who turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. That's Andy Hamilton of TrackWrestling.com. I hope you know that song. Do you know what it is?
Mama Tried.
Yeah,
Mama Tried.
You got it.
Mama Tried.
People should know Merle Haggard. I don't know if a podcast generation would know who Merle Haggard is, but go look up Merle Haggard and listen to Mama Tried, and you're going to see one of the best country songs ever made.
I think Thomas Gilman had a walkout. He might have walked out to Mama Tried.
Really?
I think so.
Mama Tried?
I think so. What was his? It was some kind of Merle Haggard song. Now you got me.
Okie from Muskogee?
No,
no way.
It was not.
No way would it be that song. But Mama Tried would make sense. I'm just trying to think of what else is in his...
Fight Inside of Me. That's what it was.
Okay.
I stand corrected.
Okay. Hey, walkout music is one of the best things that's ever happened to our sport. I think it's fantastic. I love just hearing what the entrance songs are going to be. But I'm disappointed in us that we haven't talked more about Fresno State's RTC. We gave a lot of love to North Carolina State, deservedly, on our last show. But Fresno State's got a couple guys in Final X, and we need to celebrate that. Chamberlain and Joe Colon.
How did you go from Merle Haggard to Fresno State, though? That's what I want to know.
I can do
What's
that.
What's the connection
there? It's just
there?
Seamless.
It's a segue
I'm
there.
Just, yeah, that, there is no segue. I just popped into my head, and I said, we're going to go this
direction. You're swerving from one lane to another.
Yeah,
we are. Checking your blind spot.
We are.
Fresno State had a great season from a promotional standpoint, I think. I mean, you look at... Average 4,600 fans for home duels, put 6,800 in the seats for Illinois with Isaiah Martinez coming back to California. As you mentioned, Jason Chamberlain, Joe Colon in Final X. I think there's a lot of really good things going on out there. You look at the foundation that's in place with all the things you need to be successful, and there are a lot of pieces to the puzzle already in place there with such a fertile recruiting ground. You look at what the Tirapelli brothers have done in Clovis with two powerhouse programs there. And like I said, there's just there's some really good things in place that could make that program really strong. Especially, you know, wrestling, we need programs out west for certain. And you look at the programs that are in place out west out there, and you got Stanford and Cal Poly, and the admission requirements there, the entrance requirements to get into school, they're pretty difficult. I doubt I could have gotten into one of those two schools, but I know for certain I'm not getting into Stanford when I'm 18 years old, there are more options now. And you look at it, California's got more participation numbers than any other state in the country, but per capita, probably fewer options than most from a college standpoint. So it's nothing but positives of what occurred out there at Fresno State this past year. And I think a lot of positives moving forward too.
It's
a great, great support from the administration, school president, big time behind wrestling, and so that's really positive to see.
I always wonder what the ceiling is for schools on the West Coast. Arizona State was the aberration in 1988. They got it done, a huge accomplishment. But other than that, it's been a Big 12, Big 10 show. NC State, as we talked to Pat Popolizzo, they've got it going on. I think they can go higher in the standings, but what team can knock off Penn State, Ohio State, Iowa, Oklahoma State, Minnesota to get on that top spot? I don't know what it's going to take for an ACC team to do it, what it's going to take for a Fresno State or a Stanford to ever get to that level where they're winning a national championship. I don't know that we'll ever see that. I think that there's such a stranglehold with the Big Ten. Big 12 slipped a little bit, but I think they're coming back with a full slate of teams. I don't know. I just don't see the ceiling being the top spot, but I think that a trophy is certainly doable for a Fresno State if they keep doing the things they're doing.
Well, you mentioned the show we had last week with Pat Papalizio, North Carolina State. Could anyone a decade ago imagine that they'd be doing the things that they're doing now?
No, not at all.
If we went back 14, 15, 20 years ago and said the same thing about Missouri, you know, they were the doormat of the Big 12 or Big 8. And when there were five schools in that conference, it was pretty much, you know, what, Oklahoma State, Iowa State, Nebraska, and then, you know, Missouri was kind of along for the ride.
Yeah, the little one, Big 4, little one.
Yeah, exactly. And what Brian Smith has done there. So you're seeing some places that have made some tremendous strides, and I wouldn't put the ceiling on a program like that has such a fertile recruiting base to work with and support from the school president. Those two things to me are integral in building a powerhouse program outside of where they exist now.
And that's very true. I think you have to have that administrative support, and the programs we've seen that haven't done as well, I think a lot of the frustration stems from coaches saying we just don't have the athletic administration behind us. And what it does, you can skyrocket. And NC State was a great example. Debbie Yao, I think she was at Maryland for a while. And I'll tell you, Pat Santoro spoke highly of what she did and how she was able to get them to the next level. So it has to be there and it has to be in place, because if the highest level doesn't let you get there, you ain't going to get there. Administration has to get there. Now, a guy like Jay Robinson, I think he would say they succeeded in spite of maybe some administrative support. I don't know what it was like, but again, it's a Big Ten school. You have some resources with NC State, what they're doing, the ground they're breaking. It's pretty remarkable.
South Dakota State, too.
Yeah.
We've had Chris Bono on this program, and he has talked at length about the kind of support that he got when he was at South Dakota State that I'm sure will still be there for Damian Hahn, which probably made that position attractive to Damian Hahn. Knowing that you have people that are pulling for you that aren't gonna set limits on what you can do, that are, you know, the people that are trying to accomplish the highest goals, that they're not content with just being what was South Dakota State 13th this year.
Yeah,
you know, first, they're thinking about climbing a dozen more notches on that ladder.
Yeah, and it takes a while, but I think that every coach, if you ask them, their goal is to win a national championship as a team. I think you have to play that line. Yeah. I think you have to say it, whether you're at Navy or Army or Air Force. I think they're going to say that. It's not realistic. We both know that. We know that you can't win at one of the military schools and some of these other schools that have programs. Campbell, I mean, Kerry Cola is doing a phenomenal job at Campbell. Phenomenal job. But can they win it? I don't know what his athletic administrative support is, so it's hard to know what their level could be, what their ceiling is. But Penn State, they have unbelievable athletic administrative support, and a lot of it stems from the club system, too. The Nittany Lion Wrestling Club means everything to those guys. Getting them to stay around in the program, that's huge.
You have trouble saying Nittany Lion.
I really do. Nittany Lion. I said it there second time. Nittany Lion. Should I go NLWC? Would that be better?
I like hearing you say Nittany Lion Wrestling
Club. Yeah, I got it there. I'm nailing it now.
Here you go. We're going to roll.
Nittany
now.
Lion Wrestling Club.
You always say Nittany Lion. Nittany Lion.
You're right, man. And there's kind of a fear that comes with, because I know you're kind of coming into it, and the first time it comes out, you kind of butcher it. And it's just, you get through the initial shock, and then you get to the right pronunciation. But that's a, hey, they're well-funded and gives you an outlet to compete beyond college, because they don't want those guys to leave. They want their best talent to stay in-house. And it's a pretty simple system, but it just takes a lot of work to get there.
Well, I think the point that you make about all the coaches saying that their goal is to win a national title is probably pretty correct. Because I think the minute that you start selling yourself short and you start selling your athletes short, I think that then you create this culture where yeah, maybe this is good enough. You know, maybe just qualifying for the NCAA championship is good enough, or maybe sneaking on the stand, finishing eighth is good enough. Whereas I think if you set your goals at the highest levels, you're more apt to reach. I always heard Gable and Brands talk about this. If you set your goal to be an Olympic champion, you're much more apt to become an NCAA champion. If you set your goal to become an NCAA champion, odds are greater that you're going to become an All-American because of the standard that you're holding yourself to. Whereas if you set your goal to be an All-American and you don't become an All-American, then what do you have? So I think a lot of coaches in the sport are wired that way to set their goals at the highest levels and hold their athletes to that standard.
And when you go to these tournaments, it's amazing because even at the World Team Trials, you just see a lot of coaches that you know they had the expectations, and it's getting more and more all the time where Damian Hahn, he goes from Cornell as an assistant coach, and he is planning on doing something special at SDSU. Same with Chris Bono to Wisconsin. So the level is extremely high, and they have high expectations on what they're going to get accomplished. And of course, not everyone gets to do it. That's why Penn State's dominating like they do, because they have the formula. They know what needs to be accomplished. But I just wonder if we could get a coach, though, that says our goal is not to win a national team championship. It's to X, whatever that is. If it's get all Americans to have a great student athlete, I don't know. But there's got to be some knowledge for some of these programs to know we don't have the budget. We don't have the funding. Like a Duke, let's take them. There's no realistic way with no scholarships that you can win a national team tournament. So I'd like to know what, because of that, is there a different expectation? Hey, we just want to get maybe an individual national champion and develop them that way. I'd like to get an honest answer on that because Duke's never going to win it.
Let's get Glenn Lanham on the show. I think
I'd love it.
He's done a heck of a job down there.
He has. I mean, especially with Jacob Casper. I mean, you had him on the show, our last live show that we had with On the Mat before we went to this format. You had on Jacob Casper and had great insight into what it takes to get to that level with no scholarship, and what he's done is pretty amazing given the shortcomings and resources. And I'd love to know what that athletic administrative support would look like at Duke.
Yeah. You look at it and they're the only varsity sport on campus there that doesn't have scholarships, athletic scholarships. And
is that right? I didn't remember that. That's
And it's almost $70,000 per year to go to school there. And look at some of the things that they have to do. They don't wrestle. If I'm not mistaken, they don't wrestle dual meets first semester. Some of the obstacles that are in place are that, you know, their guys are off working in the summer. There are a lot of obstacles that Duke deals with. It's a pretty interesting story there. And to do what they've done here in the past few years is pretty remarkable.
And if I could, I'd like to make another lane change, but want to make sure we mention that our guest today is Nancy Schultz. She will receive the Order of Merit from the National Wrestling Hall of Fame this weekend. And of course, she's best known as the widow of Dave Schultz, 1984 Olympic champion, who was tragically murdered on January 26, 1996. But she's done so much for the sport of wrestling. We get to delve into what she's done in the sport, why she stayed involved in the sport. We'll bring up some topics of conversation about Dave Schultz. But I want to get to something that you told me. You said that Mike Trout might be the greatest player of all time in baseball. And this came about when I said, is Mike Trout the best player in baseball right now? You said he might be the greatest player of all time. That took me aback when you said that. I had a hard time with that. I couldn't quite conceptualize that. Can you delve into why? And then I'm going to make another lane change on why I think this is important for our next topic of conversation.
Well, he's 26 years old. And baseball is at a point now where analytics use is higher than ever. You got studies of shifts based on where guys are apt to hit the ball. That's shifts are being used more than ever. Relievers are being used at more of a specialist rate. You got guys coming in out of the bullpen, everybody throwing 98 mile per hour or more, unless they're dropping down, throwing sidearm as a right-handed specialist or a left-handed specialist. And he's put up to this point in his career, first 8 years of his career, he's already a 60-win player, 60 wins above replacement level, which is a higher level metric used to measure just everything, offense at the plate, base running, defense. For perspective, that's already higher than Kirby Puckett, a higher win total than Kirby Puckett achieved in his entire career. There's some other really good players that didn't, that weren't 60 win players for their career. Trout's already there. He's probably going to become a 100 win player before he turns 30. Look at the things he's done. AL MVPs. He's already won two of them. The first five full years he was in the bigs, he was first or second in MVP balloting. He probably could have won. Probably could have won all five. He was fourth last year, despite missing 48 games, and he's, like I said, 26. Baseball, typically they say 27 to 31 are your peak years. He hasn't even hit that yet. He's doing some historic things, and he's doing it at a time where the game is better than ever. The players that he's facing, like I said, the guys, the velocities that he's seeing when he steps into the box, and you know, he can do it all. He can do, you know, he's a power hitter. He's one of the fastest players from home plate to first base. He can steal bases. He's already got 177 steals in his career. He's only been caught 32 times. This year looks like he might hit 50 home runs and potentially steal 30. It's never been done before.
So hearing you say all that, it makes me sad, number one, that we don't have those metrics in wrestling. We had a good podcast and a healthy conversation about what those metrics could be, and we've still put that King's hat on Jason Bryant to be the guy for wrestling stats. But let's translate that to today. Could we make that claim while they're competing for a Jordan Burroughs, for a Kyle Snyder, that with you saying Mike Trout might be the greatest player of all time, could we say it's possible that Jordan Burroughs might be the greatest wrestler of all time, and knowing that he still has career left in him? Same with Kyle Snyder. He's not there yet, but can we make that claim at this point in their careers? I think it's a fascinating conversation. Everyone wants to talk about who's the greatest. It's never going to get solved, but it's still fun to talk about that, especially in a sport like wrestling where there's not a lot of metrics. It's all based on championships. I think Jordan Burroughs is right in the conversation in the top five.
Well, wrestling's better now than it was 20 years ago. Don't you think?
I think so. I think it's a better product. I think you're right. I think especially with the youth movement, guys getting better all the time. It's hard to quantify eras because you do have differences that we've talked about, but it's really good right now. It's really good. And for a 19-year-old to win the world championships, that just doesn't happen by accident. There has to be a lot of pieces in play. And I think what Kyle Snyder is doing right now is probably comparable to what you just said about Mike Trout. He's doing some things that, with our metrics, that kind of leave you shaking your head and wondering, how did he get to this point?
Yeah, I think the thing with Trout is he came up and struggled a little bit his first year in the big leagues, played like 40 games, and then came back the next year and set the world on fire. 30 home runs, 49 steals, hit 326. And that's when I was thinking about this, thinking about some of the things that you're going to throw at me, I wondered, after you were over at my place the other night, we were having this discussion, I thought this might come up in the podcast. And so then I thought, like, where's Kyle going to go with this from a wrestling standpoint? So I started thinking about Snyder a little bit, and in the sense that he didn't win the NCAA championships his first year. He dropped four matches that first year, lost a couple times to Kyvan Gadson, lost to Morgan McIntosh in the Big Ten finals, lost to Nathan Burak in the dual meet. And then about, what, 6-7 months later, wins a world title.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that we were necessarily ready for Kyle Snyder to be that good that fast, to rise that meteorically. So I think that maybe there's some similarities to that. And then the consistency and that he has displayed from 2015 on the world stage has been pretty remarkable as well. And so there are some parallels there, yeah, I think, as well. So the question now, you asked me how good I think Trout is. I think he might be the best player who's ever lived based on what he has done over a 7-8 year period against at a time when I think the game is better than ever. He has dominated the game for 7 years at a point where I think the game is better than it's ever been. Kyle Snyder has dominated the game for now a 3-year stretch at a point where I think the sport is better than it's ever been. So longevity will be the key for both of them. Can they string together, you know, 15 years of this kind of high level success? Or maybe in Kyle's case, you know, the wrestling career isn't as quite as long as, you know, your window of opportunity isn't quite as long as it is in baseball, but can Kyle do it for a decade straight and really put up some huge numbers from a gold medal standpoint? He's already on track, but there will be people coming behind him too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's somebody that we haven't heard of right now that we'll be talking about in 5 years, giving Kyle Snyder a run for his money, or at least pushing him in within the United States.
So would you say that Kyle Snyder is the Mike Trout? Was that a good comparison to say what they're doing parallels each other as far as what they're accomplishing in their respective sports?
Yeah, I think so.
I think that's right
comparison. I don't know. You know, you look at a year-by-year basis, and shoot, you could look at Mookie Betts right now with Red Sox. People are arguing, is he the best player in the game? Well, he's done it for 1 year. He's done it for, you know, a couple years, but last year he wasn't as productive. So there are some guys that will pop up here and there and have a really good year and then take a step back maybe for a year. And then the key is stringing them together. Jordan Burroughs has strung them together. He's had, you know, three out of the gate. Yeah. And then he got hurt in the 2014 World Championships. Mm-hmm. He comes back the next year, wins World Gold in Las Vegas, has the slip up in Rio, but comes back the following year. I think the one thing that you're talking about elite athletes here and being the absolute best is they make adjustments. They address their weaknesses. We've seen Jordan Burroughs continue to evolve. Right in the beginning, he was scoring based off takedowns and pushouts. Then the next year he was adding some turns to his game. Then the following year, nobody, you know, he went to work on parterre defense and now nobody turns him. So that's the thing that I see in Mike Trout too. I think what 2014 season pitchers were pitching him up in the strike zone and they were getting him to chase a little bit. And that was his weakness. And you saw everybody trying to attack him with high fastballs. Then all of a sudden he starts mashing high fastballs about 460 feet. And so now you wonder, where do you pitch him and how do you get him out? And I think that that's what separates the great ones from the all-timers, the all-time bests, is they find ways to shore up the places that people think they might be able to attack them a little bit, and then they become bulletproof in those areas.
You reminded me of a couple things here. I think either last show or two shows ago, I had said that Jordan Burroughs had had 4 losses on his record, forgot the 2014 World Championship, so that's probably up to 5. So only 5 losses in Jordan Burroughs' career once he graduated from college. So from 2011 until 2018, he's only had 5 losses on his record. That's truly a incredible achievement that he has. And then to your point about the 2015 World Championships, when Kyle Snyder beat out Jake Varner, when he won the U.S. Open over Jake Varner, I didn't get a chance to watch that match, so I had to go back and watch it, because I just said there's no way he could have beaten Jake Varner. He was our Olympic champion. He just got out of a freshman year. I just said, I got to see what happened here. How did he win it? And then he goes on, he beats Jake Varner, beats him at the World Team Trials, goes on and wins the World Championships. That really did set up a run that we've seen here, and we're right in the midst of it. So he has 3 championships. He's on that course to say he might be the greatest of all time.
He's beaten some unbelievable wrestlers along the way too.
Yeah.
You mentioned Varner, but then Gadisov, he beat Sagalaev last year. It's been pretty phenomenal what he's done. And to me, the thing that's been most impressive is just the level of consistency. And he'd drop a match here and there over the course of the last 3 or 4 years. I think one in the World Cup that was a little bit flukish a year ago, where he pretty much controlled the match for about 5 minutes and 30 seconds and was only up, I think he was up maybe 4-0 or something, or 3-0, and then got hit with a 4-pointer on the edge. And it was like, whoa, how did that happen? But Kyle's been remarkably consistent when it counts most.
Yeah. And didn't he lose a couple at the Clubs Cups, maybe two or three matches there? I know he dropped one to Varner at the Olympic Trials in 2016, but other than a few here and there, it's just been
lost one to Regan.
Andy, let's bring on our guest for today. Nancy Schultz is getting a big honor this weekend at the National Wrestling Hall of Fame. She is receiving the Order of Merit, has had a huge influence in the sport of wrestling for a variety of reasons. Dave Schultz Wrestling Club founder has been involved with the Dave Schultz Memorial Wrestling Tournament and the Dave Schultz High School Wrestling Excellence Award. Nancy, how are you?
I'm doing great. It's a pleasure to be here with you guys.
Well, we know you so much for wrestling, but it's my understanding that you didn't really know all that much about wrestling until you met Dave Schultz. Is that right? Did you know anything about the sport before meeting Dave?
I knew very little other than occasionally we got to use the wrestling mats when I was a gymnast. That's about all. In fact, when I first met Dave, I asked if he had a birth defect because I thought his cauliflower ear. He just about fell off his chair laughing at me. So I was definitely a newbie when it came to wrestling when I met him. We met in college and were married while we were still in college. So, and it was off and running.
And you were born and raised in Illinois?
I was, yes, in southern Illinois, near the outskirts of St. Louis, Missouri. I still have extended family in that area.
Yeah, what was that like being in Illinois? I mean, I guess we see you in Oregon now in wrestling, but was there a good vibe, a good experience growing up?
My family was wonderful. I had the most loving, kind parents that interested in everything I did and promoted my education really well. So, and then around the time I was 12, then I moved to Norman, Oklahoma, and life changed a little bit. That's where I became a competitive gymnast and went on to compete in high school and somewhat in college, but pretty much my career was over by then.
Do you attach yourself with Illinois at all, going to Oklahoma at age 12? Are you more an Oklahoman than you would be an Illinoisan?
I attach it just because my family's still there. I still have a lot of family in the St. Louis area. So okay. In fact, I'm going after the honors weekend in Stillwater. I'll fly to Benton, Illinois, where my 93-year-old father is living with his wife and see some cousins and things like that. So I still attach myself to Illinois in a family way.
How'd you get involved in gymnastics?
University of Oklahoma, Paul Zert and Bart Connor were very involved in gymnastics there at the university. And so I was about 12 or 13 and started going over to the university and taking classes and things like that. And then evolved and my high school offered a gymnastics team. So then I became a competitive gymnastics through the high school programs.
So once you met Dave and found the sport, was it love at first sight? Or do you have to grow into this a little bit and understand what wrestling was all about?
I think, because of my background in gymnastics, I at least understood, you know, the demands when you want to be a successful athlete. And I think that helped me understand Dave and his quest. And I knew that, you know, in order for him to achieve what he wanted to, Olympics, Worlds, et cetera, that I was going to have to be, you know, pulling in the same direction. So I think it gave us a base to work from. And it was love at first sight. Dave and I only knew each other a couple months, and this is kind of a funny story. He said, do you want to go travel with me? And he said, yeah. I said, of course I do. And he said, well, then you have to marry me. And that was on a Tuesday, and we got married on a Thursday.
Really? So, it was two-day turnaround?
Back then it was, yeah.
Wow.
It was 2 days. So my mom was kind of sad and happy, sad that she wasn't going to get to invite a lot of people, and happy because the budget was really low for 2 days.
Well, tell us about the wedding. What was the wedding like?
Yeah, we just wrote on the wrestling room at the University of Oklahoma, Dave and Nancy getting married Thursday. And that was it. That was our entire invitation list. So we went to a church where I had attended some Kim programs when I was younger, and we had a wedding on Thursday, and the party was at Jeff Callard's house afterwards, another OU wrestler who had the pin record at University of Oklahoma for years. And that was our wedding. And then I think we went to Edmonton, Canada right away for the world championships.
Do you feel like your life was like that? Just kind of an ongoing, just, hey, you meet people and interact with them and you build relationships. And it was just, everyone was kind of on the same team. Did it feel that way?
Yeah, I think wrestling has this remarkable camaraderie and family relationships that you build through this sport that are really unique. I mean, I did gymnastics, my son played basketball, my daughter rode horses and things, but wrestling is unlike anything else. And I think there's a couple reasons for it. I think one, first of all, there's not a lot of money in wrestling. So, you know, I know when Dave was first competing, when we traveled, we didn't stay in hotels and things. You know, we would stay at friends' houses. And not only do you need each other for the support system, but you need each other for the sport. You can't wrestle by yourself. So there's this relationship that develops. And as well, you not only have to wrestle, you have to wrestle with somebody close to your weight, so it's possible you compete against them. So I think all these factors, along with the physical actually touching each other, create this really remarkable community and closeness and reliance that's unique to our sport that I think most don't have.
Was Dave the same person throughout the process, the Dave that you met? Was he the same Dave throughout all of this?
I think he was. I mean, you know, I think you get wiser, and especially as you get older in wrestling, your training style has to change a little. You can't compete at 32 the same way you competed when you were 21. So you need a little more off time. You know, you can't beat your body up as much. You have to have a little more recovery and healing time. So, and he changed the diversity of his training changed. So, you know, he always had like an alternative training. Sometimes it was literally running through the woods. Sometimes he did Tai Chi. He always kind of developed a side habit or program to kind of keep things fresh and new. But I think his philosophy, he had this lovely childlike awe of the world, you know, just open-hearted, open-minded, and was curious of new things and new people throughout his lifetime.
I've heard people call Dave a wrestling savant, a starving artist, is a wrestler. Are those accurate descriptions of Dave?
I think so. He had a really remarkable, like, mathematical mind when it came to wrestling, just fulcrums and angles and pivot points. And, you know, he could figure out where your weaknesses were. And it was very mathematical in his concepts. So, and I think that was unique, which made him the great technician. He didn't just kind of walk through it bodily. He actually thought it out mathematically. And I think it put him in a position to not only knew what his, you know, his next move would be, but he was kind of playing chess in his head, which was, if you move here, I'll do this. If you move here, I'll do this. If you move there, I'll do this. So he was kind of three steps ahead in preparation for the next move in any wrestling match. And I think that, you know, really gave birth to his array of technical abilities.
Did he ever try to pick your brain with gymnastics, and how did he tap into you and your skill set?
I think he tried to break my ankles when he tried to pick my brain. I had my share of gut wrench, sore ribs, and ankles bruised with cross-ankle tilts. I think a lot of he sought my attention just as far as the emotional state. I think part of my job was to maintain a healthy, happy household and maintain an environment where he could concentrate on his success and not have a lot of chaos in our personal environment. And I think we successfully did that. You know, we were married for 15 years, and it was blissful and fun and calm in a way, even though the wrestling was certainly important and kind of a high level. Our personal life was very calm with a lot of people and a lot of friends involved.
Zeke Jones has said that Dave had a million best friends. Do you think Dave knew that they were all thinking the same thing about him?
I think Dave developed friendships purposefully. So did he know that he was close with a lot of people? Yes. Did he kind of have this idea that there's a million people in the world that think I'm great? I don't think he saw it in that way. You know, Dave was very humble. He saw himself as someone that could learn from everyone. And I think when you have that attitude that you listen to people and give them your full attention, and people respond to that. You know, in this busy day and age, we're not always taking the time to look at who's in front of us and look them in the eye and really listen. And he had a very remarkable ability to do just that, was just really be with each person. And, you know, I've heard Kerry Collot say he was 15 and Dave took him in a corner and said, "Hey, can you show me that move?" Or, you know, ask a coach what their philosophy is about, you know, traveling and competing too soon or, and things like that. So he really listened to people. And I think in response to that, people felt special when they were in his presence.
Team Foxcatcher, Emmy nominated, and you were a part of getting that documentary out. It's fantastic. Just some unprecedented footage that you have there. Well, was that cathartic
Thank
experience
you so much.
Going through that? Was that a good experience for you?
It was a fantastic experience for me. I'm not sure cathartic is the word. You know, we did it in 2013, and you know, by that time I had spent, you know, the trials were by far behind me, and I had run the Schultz Club for many years. But what was lovely is just to get back in touch with all the people that, you know, knew Dave well, and share some of the times that we'd spent together, and share pictures and stories and videos. I think it was really great for my kids to hear, you know, some of the things that their dad did when they were younger, you know, too young to remember parts of it. For me, it was probably one of the most important things I've ever done is to document Dave's life.
Did you get good response from other people about it?
It was amazing. Yeah, we were, I can't remember how many months we were the number one documentary on Netflix, but it was remarkable. And the Netflix people did a great job of promoting our film and making it available. The producers, Jeremy Baylor and Ben Hatta, you know, were great people to work with. The director, John Greenhall, has been a friend of mine for years, and we're probably brother and sister close now after spending 7 years working on that project together. So everyone involved with it was extremely helpful, and it was a heartfelt project.
Can you take us behind the scenes a little bit on Netflix and how that works? Because it's the outlet right now that everyone wants to get on, and everyone has Netflix. What was that like? Did they keep you up to date on numbers? Just take us through some of that with Netflix and how that works.
Well, I think there's a variety of ways that a film gets made. And actually, you know, I can give you a little bit. You know, John Greenhall, the director, was handling most of it, and also the producers were handling a lot of it. But basically, there's a couple different ways. One is that you go to Netflix with an idea, and they basically buy into the idea and help fund you, you know, and create the movie together. The other one was the way we did it is that we basically made the film all with the wrestling community. You know, most of our investors are wrestlers from the University of Pennsylvania and other, there's a few others, but that was our base and people that knew and trained with Dave when we were in Philadelphia. And, you know, I'll forever be grateful for those guys who stepped up and provided the funding to make the movie. And then once we got the finished project, then we got a hold of Ben Cotner at Netflix, and he graciously, you know, took a lot of time to watch the movie. And then they had some freedom to make some editing changes and title changes and a few things at the end. But I have to say, they really let us remain true to the film that we'd made. And then they purchased the film from us. And then, you know, then it's theirs and they start promoting it. We had this amazing 30-year contract with Netflix, and Team Foxcatcher continues to be a successful film on Netflix.
There was, of course, a tragic ending with Foxcatcher and how it all transpired. But of what took place, how many of those years were good years? It seemed like there were some really good times during the Foxcatcher Farms time period. What would you quantify as good years?
They were all good years. You know, John DuPont was very... you didn't know what to expect with him, right? He had high highs and low lows. He not only probably had some sort of mental illness, and you know, from his early childhood, but he also had covered it up with alcohol and drugs for many, many, many years. And he just was very volatile. So, but most of the time at the farm, you know, John was doing his own thing and the wrestlers were training. So, you know, we had this huge, big family. Kids could just go from house to house to house and, you know, be comfortable every place and barbecues and family outings and just shared time and everybody's pulling in the same direction. You know, there was, and it wasn't just wrestling. It was swimming, pentathlon, triathlon. And everybody's, you know, trying to do the same thing. So everybody's on the same page. It was amazing shared experience. It's, we just didn't know that John was dangerous.
So was he a bad guy then or not?
Oh, you know, I think that's too easy a label.
I think
he was damaged. You know, I think he was damaged from a young age. His upbringing was not good for a child. He was socially isolated, raised on the Foxcatcher by himself. He was homeschooled. He didn't get a chance to really integrate with children. I think there's maybe some mental health issues from early on. You know, maybe when he was even a child, there's some indications. And no one did anything about it. He was the last of the DuPont children, and he wasn't want, they didn't really want to see him or have him around. And then over years, I think the power and wealth overtook, you know, his common sense. He had too much money and too much power, especially for someone who's not mentally healthy. So I don't know. I don't think labeling somebody bad or good. I think we have to look at the road that they traveled to get to where they did. And his was troubled from the very, very beginning.
After Dave's murder, you really took a role in the sport of wrestling and elevated us to another level, as evidenced by you getting the Order of Merit. Did you know right away that you wanted to stay involved and really make an impact through the sport?
Not right away. You know, the first couple of weeks after Dave's murder, I was definitely, you know, living in a police station, trying to protect my kids from the media. I was in, you know, a little bit of swirl, but our life had been steadfastly in wrestling for so long. And in the back of my brain, I always was thinking about, okay, what about the other guys? Where are they going to train now? You know, where are they going to do? Where's the funding coming from? What are they going to, how are they going to get to the Olympic trials? Because it's January and the Olympics are in what, in the fall, and they got to get through the national open, the Olympic trials. So always in the back of my head was swirling, you know, what are these guys doing? What's Dolph doing? What's Shade doing? How are they getting this guy going to prepare? So I think really quickly, with the amount of attention that I got and the amount of support that I was receiving, not only from the wrestling community, but from pretty much around the United States, I knew that I could do something to help. So I got some of the Hawkeye, nonprofit bylaws to see how it was done. And I'd been in sports administration myself earlier in the gymnastics venue. So we formed a nonprofit, and Ed Geezy helped me, and ASICS helped, and the United States Olympic Committee helped. And pretty soon we had enough money to get from January, at least through the Olympic trials. And my thought then was that the athletes after the Olympic trials, you've either made an Olympic team and you're going to be USA Wrestling's budget, you know, in their funds, or you didn't make the team and you're going to kind of fall back and see out what you're going to do with next year. And I kind of thought that would be the end of it. I think I would do that for 6 months and get done. But we kept going for about 12 more years after that. So it worked out. It was a great venture, and it kept my children involved in the people that were important in their lives.
Was there ever a time you kind of had to check out of the sport and just get away?
Well, at the time I closed the Schultz Club down, I didn't know. I didn't check out. I just, there was more support then. This one club was less needed, so I knew that I could have the athletes go to other clubs and they'd find support. And after 12 years, I think, you know, I'd been working really hard, and I think I just needed to take a breath. But I can never get away from this sport. This is my family. This is where I'm at my happiest when I'm around wrestling.
Nancy, your son, Xander, his presence in the sport has been more prevalent here in the last couple of years as he worked to try to get Prowl going. What can you tell us about Xander?
About Xander? Xander is so great. He's such a great heart and a great soul. He reminds me of Dave in so many ways. His desire to help people and be involved is huge. I do think, you know, he's set forth to do the Prowl, and although it didn't come out exactly the way it laid out, those types of ideas are going to be carried forward. There's going to be some competitions and stuff that kind of use the blueprint that they were laying out. So that's really cool. Xander has an amazing heart, and he's really intelligent. So I just watch him as he gets involved with all these nonprofits. He's quite involved in the Black Lives Matter movement in New York. You know, he started a nonprofit that raises money for refugees that came over from Syria and into Greece. He's just constantly working on new things and new ways to help people.
Can you fill us in again on the great story? I just want to make sure we get this story out there. It's such an awesome story about when your daughter wanted to sit on Mark Ruffalo's lap during the filming and what what that meant to her. That's such a great story. If you can kind of tell what transpired there.
Yeah. Well, I just, you know, Bennett Miller did a great job of creating a movie about the Foxcatcher. You know, some of the time periods are a little different, but when you look at the characters he developed, you know, the Steve Carell's character as John DuPont was just amazing. And, Channing, you know, portrayal of Mark and some of the struggles that he went through, I think is so impressive. And then you get Mark Ruffalo, who studied so hard, you know, watching Dave wrestle and practicing wrestling with Dave's teammates and really putting such effort. So we showed up on the set, and they were shooting a scene where Mark Ruffalo and Sienna, so Dave and Nancy, are with the kids playing in a pile of leaves, and they were recreating a scene from our home movies. So, you know, Danny kind of leaned over me and said, you know how people say they want to go back in time and relive a moment? You know, we're actually reliving a moment in our past currently. And so they finished filming the scene, and Mark Ruffalo comes over and introduces himself to Danny, and Danny just looked at him. She said, I know I'm 21, but could I just sit in your lap for a moment? And he gave her a big hug, and, you know, they really hit it off. And I can't say enough nice things about Mark Ruffalo. He's an amazing human being who has time for everything that's important, you know, people and topics and politics. And he's really super.
What do people want to talk about when they meet you for the first time?
Mostly Dave, I think. You know, Dave was such an unusual character. And then when someone leaves us young, it kind of leaves a hole. So I think people maybe want to get, they might know one part of Dave and want to know a little bit more. Kind of rounding out their version of what they knew and what they've heard.
What do you think Dave would be doing right now in 2018?
Laughing at my induction into the Hall of Fame.
You think he would be?
Oh, yes. He'd be poking fun at me terribly.
Really?
You never wrestled. What are you doing?
Yeah. So with the Order of Merit, though, I mean, how cool is that, that you and Dave are both in the Hall of Fame together? You're from Oklahoma. This is in Stillwater. That has to be really special for you.
It is so humbling. I can't even imagine. And, you know, I really feel this is kind of an award that's going in the wrong direction. Literally, I should be giving people an award for all of the help and the support and the assistance I've had, anywhere from, you know, sitting in court, the wrestlers beside me during the criminal trial, and helping me gather information for the civil trial, and helping me get my kids to lessons and baseball practice. And just every step of the way, the wrestling family has carried me through. So I really feel like I should turn this award around and hand it right back to everybody who's helped me through these last years.
I mean, I like the humility. I disagree completely, because I think you totally deserve this award for all you've done. But I think just what you said there too reminds me of something Dave said when he won the Olympic gold medal. I think he'd chop it up into pieces and give a piece to everyone that helped him along the way. Wasn't that a quintessential Dave Schultz quote?
He did. And I plan to actually say that, you know, to the people that are giving me this award. Is like Dave said once, if he had to divide up the gold medal into all the pieces and share it with people that helped him, you know, win it, that you wouldn't recognize it as a medal at all. And I feel the same way about this award. It's just so many people played a role in my ability to stay in the sport of wrestling, that's the little pieces should go out to so many people.
As far as big pieces, if you had to maybe give three big pieces to people that really made it a difference for you, who would those pieces go to?
Well, I know that Greg Alinsky, he wrestled the Penn State, you know, he was right there within a couple hours of Dave being killed, and helped guide me through some processes that were very difficult for me. And as far as press control, he helped me hire a team that helped me deal with the press, because they were in my yard and following my kids. And he stepped up and really held my hand through those first couple years and through the civil trial, and helped me to stabilize myself. You're going through a process you've never been before, and he helped. And he's also been probably the most outstanding father figure, but I call him an uncle. How's that? Since we're not replacing Dave, but we're adding to their lives. He's just been someone that my kids have looked up to all the time. And when they weren't doing well in school or something, I could, you know, have Uncle Greg give him a call and give him a boost. And Dan Shade, you know, my daughter Danny is named after Dan Shade. He and his wife, Teresa, were there every step of the way. They were at every baseball game, every, school dance, everything my kids did, they had those people nearby, to thank, to be with all the time and to support them. And it was huge.
That's two. I got to get one more.
That's two?
Yeah.
David Lee from wrestled at Stanford University. He was, I think, the first to hold both of my children when they were born. So he's been a constant in their life that they could always turn to him for advice and support. But it's really hard for me to pick three. You know what I mean? You know how this
Oh, sure.
is. You know, everyone has done. Kenny Monday has been a great friend to Alexander. Les Gutchess has been amazing. I could keep going on and on. Ed Geezy helped me run the wrestling club when I first started the Dave Schultz Wrestling Club. You know, Myron Roderick is the one that said that I could do this in the beginning. You know, he used. So, I mean, I could just go on forever, but no one does, you know, involved in the sport by themselves.
Rudis is taking wrestling by storm. Everywhere you go, you see Rudis gear, whether it's backpacks, shirts, gear. It's just incredible what you guys have been able to accomplish there. You're a partner with Rudis. Why did you feel like that was a good fit for you?
Well, I knew Tommy Rollins and Jeff Jordan very, very well. And I knew of Jesse Lang, our managing, our partner. And I had all the respect for them in the world. And when they came to me, they had some really amazing ideas about ways to honor Dave. And in the past, there's been some lovely people who have honored Dave here and there. But they really came to me with a package and said that, look, we're going to elevate his memory. We're going to honor his career. We're going to bring out, you know, the kind of person he was in the line of products. And I saw the quality of the gear that they're doing. And it's cool, isn't it?
Oh, it's awesome.
Rudis cool. It's cool.
It is.
So when they came to me, and I could just see that they were going to really treat Dave's memory with respect. And I just wanted to be involved with the company that did that for Dave. And also I could see that we were going to change the look of wrestling. And that's exciting. You know, being in wrestling a long time, there's always new things coming up. And that was something new for me to be involved in. And I'm so proud of being involved with Rudis and what they've done with our gear in wrestling.
I mean, just as an example, Andy here is wearing a Sly Fox shirt right now. I think at least 5 days out of the 7 days I'm wearing a Rudis shirt. So it's made a big difference. Did you see that coming? Did you know that it was going to take over the wrestling world like this?
Yeah, we kind of did.
You did?
You know what? We knew that wrestling needed something new. We needed a new look. We needed some sharp stuff. And I think, you know, we were ready to put the work in. And we have. We've got a great staff. We've got a great managing group. We've got great partners. We're excited every day to put new gear out for elite athletes.
Is that rewarding, seeing that out at wrestling tournaments, seeing all the gear be Rudis and singlets and everything Rudis now?
Incredibly rewarding. Yeah, it is. And especially, you know, we got not only the Dave Schultz line, but the Sly Fox line is also kind of, you know, with his name on it, because the Russians, when he was young, they said he's kind of a sly fox. You know, he showed up, he doesn't look like much, he's a little pudgy, he's 17 years old, but yet, you know, he took second in Tbilisi. So they started referring to him as a sly fox when he was young. So that line pays tribute to him too. So yes, it's overwhelmingly satisfying to see the Rudis line spreading out to the United States.
You remember where you were the first time you saw, you know, whether it be a high school kid or whomever, wearing one of those shirts with Dave's face on it at a tournament?
You know what? One of the first things we did is we brought back the Dave Schultz Wrestling Club shirt. And that was fun because there'd been like a 15, 16 year gap between the time that they were out there in the world. And then all of a sudden, they're back and I'm seeing Dave Schultz Wrestling Club t-shirts around everywhere. So that was cool. And then, just everything that comes out with Dave's name or Sly Fox name on it, I couldn't be more proud.
Do you have a level of involvement as far as the creative side with Rudis?
Not as much. We have a team of designers and artists that are amazing, but absolutely do they touch base with me on the kinds of things we're going to put Dave's name on? For sure. But, I'm usually far, you know, they're far superior to the ideas and the designs they come up with that I can never even put my, you know, influence on. So I have to say that there's rarely been a product that didn't come full circle with just like they wanted it.
You're playing a role in the Bela Glazov brothers coming to the United States and Canada and doing a camp tour. What's your involvement in that? How did that materialize? And what do you think that people around the United States will get from those two coming around and teaching technique?
I'm so proud of this tour, but it has been a big task, I tell you. So they, Alexei Bela Glazov, which is Anatoly's adult son, he called me and said, you know, anything you can think of that we can do a camp over in the United States. And I said, well, I don't want to run a camp. I've run camps before and they're a lot of trouble. But I said, I could probably hook you up with some clinics. So, you know, and in my head, I'm thinking 5 to 10 clinics, you know, I'll just dial them in with some of the people I know that are running camps. But we rolled out. It's like a rock and roll tour. We had 22 clinics lined up from May 19th to July 8th. Today they are in Summers, New York. Tomorrow they have a day off. Next day they'll travel to Fairfax, Virginia. They get in Fairfax, Virginia, then Denver, Colorado. Oh, then Oklahoma, Denver, Colorado, St. Louis, a series of clinics in Iowa and Wisconsin. Then they come out West Coast. So it's been an amazing, amazing tour. And, you know, Dave believes that, you know, sharing information about wrestling with other international athletes was really the mainstay of making wrestling strong, not only for our country, but for other countries. Just if we interact with each other, we can make it better. And I love the idea of bringing some of these Russian athletes over here, and the Belogorzovs are amazing people, and sharing that and getting kids hands-on with somebody from Russia that they can work with, understand that people from other country, you know, can be their friend and learn amazing techniques. So it's just it's a full spectrum tour for me.
Do you remember where you met those guys, the Belogorzov brothers?
Oh my God, I saw them so many years. The first time, I can't say. Let me think about this. Probably Edmonton, Canada, maybe in 82 World Championships, possibly. Maybe the first time I met them, but I mean, we just, you know, Dave was in the competitive world for so long. So every World Cup, every World Championship, you know, if Dave wanted to go watch the Europeans, we'd go over there and see them then. So, you know, and then Sergey coached over here in the United States for years. I had Sergey do some clinics for the Dave Schultz Wrestling Club for a while. So I've been interacting with them for what, probably 30 years.
Yeah, it's a long time.
I'll see him in Oklahoma. Actually, when I get done with the Hall of Fame induction, I'm meeting them in Norman and spending a couple days with them there before they head out on their next phase. And then I'll meet them in Portland. They're going to stay at my place when they come back through West Coast. So I'll see him a couple times on this tour. And I talk to him every day.
Oh, you do?
Depending on, you know, whether. Oh, yeah. Because I'm the one that has booked all the train tickets, plane tickets, hotel reservations. So I'm literally in touch with them before the clinic, after the clinic, when they get on the train, when they get on the plane. So I'm talking to them all the time right now.
What's it like living in Oregon?
We have a really beautiful place. We bought 20 acres that I share with. There's seven of us that live here. We have three houses, and actually four houses now that Laura's yurt's going up, and we share 20 acres here. We have bear, coyote, bald eagles, cougar. We have a huge garden and an orchard. I'm becoming a farmer.
Are you? What does that entail?
A good garden, so yeah.
Okay.
Pardon?
What does that entail? You just have garden out there? You actually have a full crop of stuff?
Yeah, we had to go in and purchase a tractor. You know, we have to gravel our road. And we have to. The bears got into my bees the other day, so I had to go repair the hives and fix that. And we have a huge, huge garden with every kind of vegetable imaginable, and we have an orchard with about 15 different types of fruit trees. So, you know, I'm slowly doing a little bit less in the wrestling world and kind of settling into taking care of this property out here. But I say that all the time, but it actually doesn't slow down.
Well, hey, tell us about your husband. I won't even try to pronounce your last name. Leroy Smith tried to pronounce it in a board meeting, and he couldn't even come close to it. But just tell us how you met and what it's been like since then.
Scott Vitangeli.
Okay, Vitangeli. Okay.
Vitangeli.
Yeah. Okay.
Vitangeli. It rolls right off the tongue.
Yeah,
right?
It does.
Really easy. He's just an amazing person. You know, he came into this. We met, and he saw what I was doing with wrestling, with the Dave Schultz Wrestling Club, with foreign athletes, and he still stuck around. So he's got to be one of the bravest human beings I've ever met, despite not having wrestled.
Yeah, so he likes wrestling.
He has two wonderful children who are my stepkids, and he's just a strong, confident, loving, kind human being who I rely on for everything.
That's great. And he's in the sport all the way now.
Yeah, he's learned. He said he had to meet 2,000 people in 6 months and then make sure that he remembered the names, and they're his really close friends now.
All right. Hey, Nancy, we like to play games on this show. We have a game call the name game. I'm going to give you five names of five different people, and I just want you to tell me what you think about these individuals. You ready to play the name game?
Okay.
All right. Name number one, Valentin Jordanov.
Probably one of the greatest Bulgarian wrestlers of all time. I believe he won the world championship 7 times.
And then, yeah, I think he finally won it in 96, the Olympics. Name number two, Mark Ruffalo.
Ruffalo, most politically active, kindest human being I know.
Really?
Yeah.
Number three, Steve Carell.
Carell is such an interesting person. He comes across as an outgoing individual and funny. And in person, he's very reserved and rather shy and really lovely. And I think quite private.
So he's not anything like his character on The Office?
I think, obviously, I think everybody has a part, you know, different parts of their personality. So somewhere in there, that person exists. But I think as a whole, day to day, that's not who he is as a regular person.
All right. Number four. And I don't know how well you're going to know him, but I'm going to throw out Dayton Fix.
Dayton won the Dave Schultz High School Excellence Award, what, last year?
Yeah.
2 years ago?
Yeah.
Just a remarkable talent, well-rounded young man, obviously not just good at wrestling, but other endeavors in life. He gives back to his community. And I mean, look at his success. He just, he's an amazing young athlete. I think we're going to see a just ridiculously successful career from him.
And the final name, and you got to tell us some stories about this guy, former Oklahoma head wrestling coach, Stan Abel.
Stan, not Dan, Abel, not Gable.
Yeah, exactly.
That's all. That was his battle cry.
Yep.
You know, true advocate of the sport, obviously mentored and helped, you know, hundreds and hundreds of athletes find their success in college wrestling. Still very involved and very, he's a big package. He's loud, you know, he's around and he's fun.
Did you see him argue a lot of calls when Dave was wrestling on the sideline?
Yeah, but you know, he didn't cause that much conflict that I remember. You know,
really?
he was okay. I mean, he didn't get involved in it, but I felt like he always, I think he was pretty respectful.
All right. We appreciate you playing the name game. We appreciate you coming on the program. Tough as nails, Schultzy, right?
That's right.
All right.
Still hear the battle cry.
That's right. Hey, well-deserved on the order of merit. You've done so much for the sport and very excited to
recognize you this weekend.
It's so well-deserved. Thank you for coming on the program. For Nancy Schultz, I'm Kyle Klingman, along with Andy Hamilton. You've been listening to On the Mat.
This show is part of the Matt Talk Podcast Network.
For more wrestling podcasts, head over to MattTalkOnline.com.